What a beautiful day.
It's like we're in heaven. Only it's not heaven, is it? We are here to make the earth as much like heaven as possible. Who'd like to go first?
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 401 for the week of April 4th, 2022. I am Micro Blackout Badass David T. Cole, and I'm here with Cupcake Ninja Sarah D. Bunting.
Keeping it frosty.
Over at Gift Shop Manager Tara Ariano.
Go do the inventory!
And Later Gators aficionado Roxana Haddadi.
There's no way to improve on that. Just Later Gators.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is a TV critic at Vulture. You have heard her here before. It's Roxana Haddadi. Hello!
Woo, Roxana!
Hey, guys.
We're thrilled to have you here to talk about Moon Knight. And I'm just going to say, I watched the first episode of the show quite carefully, taking notes. I'm still not totally sure how to describe the premise, but here goes. Oscar Isaac plays Stephen Grant, a mousy clerk at the gift shop in the British Museum. He is fascinated by ancient history, but apparently is not even close to being in contention for the tour guide job he dreams of. Stephen also apparently has a problem with sleepwalking and shackles himself to his bed frame at night. As we join him, his bouts of missing time are getting scarier, starting as he wakes up with a dislocated jaw on a hillside in the Alps. Also hearing a very bossy voice in its head that sounds just like F. Murray Abraham. He finds his way to a town that seems to be run by a cult leader named Arthur Harrow, Ethan Hawke, with an animated tattoo and who really wants a golden scarab that Stephen somehow has on his person. And when Stephen blacks out, it's apparently to give control of his body to someone who is very good at fighting. What is going on with this guy or guys?
Can that actually be the synopsis that we find on Disney Plus? Can we make that happen? Some guy's good at fighting.
Yeah. let's do the Chen check-in. Roxana, very briefly, should our listeners watch Moon Knight?
I think yes, because I think it's just weird enough to be compelling. All that stuff that you listed, it's a very dense plot, but I enjoy it very much as like a late 90s mummy sort of throwback. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really give me comic book superhero vibes. It gives me old adventurer vibes, and that's something that I miss very much.
Okay.
So I would say yes. Stick with it.
Sarah.
I am going to say no, but I'm on the fence. I will say that it was, you know, this was the first episode that we watched, so it's hard to say. I will also say Oscar Isaac is awesome, and I'm tempted to put my faith in him, but based on what I saw, I'm probably not going to keep going, but I could be talked back into it.
Dave?
It's easy to recommend a Marvel series after the first episode.
Yeah.
The challenge is, can they stick the Marvel series landing?
Right.
And of course, we will have to come back in about 6 weeks for the answer to that.
Yeah.
But there's always something fun about the start of a Marvel series. So with the facts presented, I will say yes.
Yes. Roxana has seen four. The three of us have only seen one. So, you know, we'll get a little more color from her about that. But yeah, I am with Dave. I mean, I've already bitched about this this phenomenon on this podcast many times where it's like it starts out really neat and cool and weird, and then it just gets conventional with people fighting in the sky.
American Marvel story.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm on the fence. I imagine I will keep watching it just because I live in the household with someone who's more into it than me. So marginal yes. Yes, Dave.
Can we start the actual discussion on something very petty that was the thing that annoyed me the most, and I just want to get it out of the way so that I'm not like Grumpy McGee?
Yes.
I hate, capital H, hate the animated tattoo conceit.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
yes.
The cult leader, Ethan Hawke, has a tattoo that is the 2022 equivalent of the scales that weigh your soul when you're about to go into the afterlife back in the day in Egypt. But his tattoo are these scales, and they bob up and down in real time and also change color in case you didn't quite get the scale thing.
Mm-hmm.
They turn red if you're not going to have a good time.
If you're bad.
Yeah. why a tattoo? They could do anything. He could just like pull out a little pocket scale or something. I don't care. Like the tattoo thing really bugged me. Animated tattoos, they just like, they're like the Harry Potter newspaper. Like, it's just like, come on, guys.
Yes.
You can do better.
Yeah, because he's also got a cane. Like, the cane could do a thing.
the cane swings back and forth.
Right. Yes.
And it does that job.
Fair.
Thank you. Let's proceed. Roxana, in your review, which we will link in the show notes, you praised the show's compelling weirdness. You also said that in the chat and check-in, but you also expressed dismay, as Dave and I said, that it is doomed to conform to the requirements of the greater MCU industrial complex. And having been burned by so many of these Marvel shows on Disney Plus, I agree. But say more about that. What are your fears, especially having seen more of the show than we have?
So my fear is that, well, I'll say, so far, I hope this isn't a spoiler, but like maybe it is for some people. So far, within the first four episodes, there is no greater mention of the MCU world.
Okay.
There is no acknowledgement of the Avengers, Thanos, whatever. I mean, all that stuff. So on the one hand, I'm very excited by this because I would love for this to operate as a true standalone where we're just checking in with Moon Knight as what, like a C-level character bouncing around pyramids in Egypt. But on the other hand, I can't actually accept that Marvel and Disney would allow for such a thing to happen.
Right.
So I'm sort of hesitant and skeptical that in the last episode, we don't see somebody randomly pop by that has an affiliation with those other shows.
Yeah.
And I'm just exhausted by that. Like the show already, you know, it does have punchy FaceTimes. It does have some of that other Marvel stuff. But I really enjoy, and I mentioned this in my review, I really enjoy the idea that this could all come down to like translating a manuscript
or solving
a puzzle. I want those sort of low stake problem. And so far the show has done that really well. So I don't quite understand how in two episodes they could wrap up what they've done.
Right.
But I also don't quite understand how it could connect to the larger world.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm skeptically hopeful.
Well, I'll put that on the poster.
Yeah.
Sarah, you enjoy punchy FaceTimes. Was there enough of that here for you to stay engaged?
Not quite. I have a couple of issues here. And one is that I think that the low stakes phrasing is perfect because it did seem like there was going to be a sort of processy look at what might face today's sleepwalking superhero who, unbeknownst to him, is a superhero. So I was interested by that, but I also felt like the world as built by this premiere was not entirely consistent in terms of like, wouldn't someone in his life know about this? He really doesn't have any friends. Like, it just sort of took me out of the processy aspects of what this superhero situation would be. The other problem is that I feel like historically superhero / fantasy genre shows, when a character is a god versus a superhero or supernatural being, the theological implications of omnipotence are not well executed by, say, Buffy season 5. Let's just go there.
Sure.
So I am a little concerned about that, and the fact that I think this show wants to be about something not mundane, but just a little bit more like the day to day of a character like this, which Oscar Isaac could really play anything, let's face it, but is the perfect person to kind of straddle that line between that, you know, there's his mousy persona and then there's a punchy FaceTime guy.
Sure.
But I think because it's a Marvel show, It's going to be like big moments, you know, CGI quote triumphs, tattoo accepted. Yeah. And I'm just not sure that this should be a Marvel show, but it is. So I'm not sure if I continue, will I be gratified in the, you know, Grandpa Bunsy lane of things that I enjoy about a superhero character study of this sort? Probably not. And it's probably unfair of me to ask.
Well, I was interested in the way it conveys, like, it dramatizes how scary it would actually be for Steven to be in this situation.
Yes.
Like, a lot of times, you know, it's hard to find the balance of, like, having your your wonderful superhero character like accept their new situation versus creating right. believable tension. Like, if you know watching it, this is a superhero, it can be boring to be like, no, I won't do X or whatever. So I appreciate that. But, you know, another show that is also about mental illness is, I think, better done. And obviously, it's not fair to really make the comparison, but Undone season 2 is coming soon to Amazon. And that was another mm-hmm. show that I thought did a really thoughtful job of like situating you in the character's world and making you actually feel, you know, how unsettling it would be to be in this situation. So I give it credit for that. But, you know, they do get to the punching very quickly. And then a lot of it happens off screen, at least in this first yeah. episode. So that's kind of frustrating, too. Roxana, you had a lot of praise for the direction of Mohamed Diab, which, and it does seem more ambitious than the other MCU Disney event shows. Talk more about that.
You know, I liked that some of the punchy stuff was off screen mm-hmm. because I think that Diab does a good job with the transitions between the two, Stephen Grant and the other person, Mark Spector, who mm-hmm. shares this body. So I actually really liked the implications of what's happening that we don't see. Mm-hmm. And I think that for the most part, Diab and Benson and Moorhead, who have also done like some sci-fi stuff and who worked on Archive 81, which was another Netflix sci-fi show. Mm. I think they do a very good job, at least I think, in messing with linear time visually mm-hmm. and in sort of collapsing between time periods and locations. So I think for a show like this that is doing so much jumping around the world, going from the inside of a bus to the inside of a pyramid to a mountain hillside, I think they're pulling off those transitions very well. Mm-hmm. But I do agree that there is sort of this sense of when you get gods into this, which we do, mm-hmm. something that I do find curious is how do you personify those gods and how do you capture what they're capable of doing mm-hmm. and what they're choosing to do, which is nothing.
Right.
For
right.
A lot of
right. right.
So that is something that I would say, I think later on, it sort of raises some questions. And that does get to the MCU of this all. This wasn't an MCU show. What else could you be doing mm-hmm. with these characters and with this timeline? Right.
Yeah. And I just sort of kept thinking, perhaps because of the museum setting, but something that I often think of when it comes to like portraying like a supernatural power of this size is that in the Roman epics, okay, everybody just jump ahead 5 minutes. I'll try to keep this quick. In the Roman epics, like in the Aeneid, the gods are conceived of as these 10-foot tall, otherwise analogous to humans, but they're 10 feet tall and they're effulgent. Mm-hmm. Like there's a glow. Mm-hmm. It's not like Yahweh, who like you can't say the name, you can't look directly at the ark. Like it, in the Rome, the Roman gods are like big, yeah. shiny, and petty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I sort of feel like maybe that's the way to go for the Marvel verse. If you're gonna take on gods, just chop it down to size the mm-hmm. way Virgil did. I think it's your only option.
Dave, did you have something to add? Put
your hand Only up. That sometimes I am big, shiny, and petty.
Sometimes. Step it up.
Sarah, I would be very curious if you stick with it, what you think about the depiction of the gods. Because mm-hmm. I will say there is pettiness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of pettiness.
All right. Well, now you've obliged me to stick around and see. Because pettiness.
Is it ever explained, Roxana, how control of the body is traded back and forth? Because given what we've seen of Steven as Steven, it doesn't seem like he would have the strength of will to claw it back from Mark.
I think it's very barely explained when you get a couple of episodes in. Mm-hmm. But I am curious about why they chose to open with Steven. I think because he's so much more of a fun character in mm-hmm. Isaac's hands. Like the later Gator and the accent and his general sort of dandiness, I think, is very fun. Mm-hmm. But then when you meet Mark, it's like, well, this guy would certainly be in charge.
Right, yeah.
He's not trying to return a fish in a blender. That's not happening.
Yeah, he's more self-assured than that. So it is, I think, between episodes 2 and 3 that they sort of explain how it could be that one of them would lose control over the body.
Right.
And there is sort of a longer running mystery involving the gods and their avatars and what they intend to do with these avatars. So they do sort of expand that explanation a little bit.
Okay.
So there's the fun, quirky British version of Moon Knight. And his contribution whenever he's on screen is a certain amount of levity. And then he meets the cult and Ethan Hawke, and they're all like, oh, "This is good. This series got away your soul. And look at my tattoo." And I know it is sort of like even the comic book. Everybody always says like, "Oh, it's Marvel's Batman," kind of right, and that's the tone. Mm-hmm. It's, he's sort of, you know, he's the kind of character you expect to talk like this. I'm Moon Knight.
I'm in the
Gibbon phase. Watch out. I kind of wanted the cult to be fun. Like, that's where I wanted this series to settle down, where it was like just absurd ancient Egyptian war being fought by proxy and nobody knows what the fuck they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, except there is this one half that's sort of like, oh, it's the fun MCU action guy. And then there's this other half, which is Ethan Hawke is in something else. And now he's in my show here. Because I was thinking, like, what's the value proposition for everybody in this cult?
Yeah.
Like, I understand.
What's the benefit?
Yeah. Like, okay, we're in this cult and, like, everybody wants to belong somewhere. But, like, at the end of the day, that's a big roll of the dice.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go up. I'm going to be the brave guy to go up and get Wade. Either I'm going to get a pat on the back or I will be dehydrated or whatever the hell happens to that woman. Like, your soul's just sucked out. Like, there's just like a little bit of a misconnect. Cause I've read a few of the Moon Knight comics and it's pretty serious. There's a moment here, a moment there, but it definitely doesn't have this sort of like as much disparity between moods that we saw in the first episode. And it really just made me wish somehow through methods, we could have had a lighter, a goofier, a sort of incompetent, but perhaps dangerous because of their incompetency cult or something different, because I really felt like those two things weren't meshing as well as I wanted to, because the energy brought by Oscar Isaac in that like fight scene at the start, his first sort of like transitional fight scene in the van, the first big set piece was great. But then you compare that to like all the weird stuff with the cult. It just felt a bit off. And the later scene where he's being chased around the museum by a jackal or whatever that was supposed to be felt like the worst version of that. Like there was two sort of modes going on, and I wanted more of the first and less of the second.
I kind of wanted like The Good Place's Janet to show up. Like it did seem their central town area did seem like there was going to be a chowder fountain. Like why not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it would be a better show without the cult at all. Mm. Like, that's... I don't think the cult actually adds anything. Yeah. And I really don't like Ethan Hawke in this. Like I don't think he's doing anything.
Yeah. In your
review... I actually thought he was good, but I don't think it adds anything either. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Roxanne, in your review, you referred to his off the Talbot sales rack outfits, which is very funny. I would say more Eileen Fisher, but it's like, you know, 50-50. But yeah, between the outfits and his like weird wispy hair, he has a real like aging pottery teacher vibe.
He really does. Like,
he's not scary. Even with a tattoo, he's not scary. I don't know.
No. This man loves to glaze. That's it. That's it.
It is time to go around the dial talking about something we've been watching on TV lately. First up is with Tara. Tara, what do you got?
I have a highbrow show and then 1.5 lowbrow shows. So I'll do the highbrow show first. You know how we, as a culture, all agree that the movie Julie and Julia was fine, but that they could have just cut Julie and we would have all been happier?
Yep.
HBO Max knows, and they made a limited series that is that, and it is called Julia. Sarah Lancashire from Happy Valley plays Julia Child, whom we meet just after the publication of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which she co-authored. And her husband, Paul, played by David Hyde Pierce, has just been forced to retire from his job as a diplomat, so they're living in Cambridge while he paints and she works on her next cookbook. She happens to get an invitation to appear on a local PBS book chat show hosted by... Alfred Duhamel, or Albert, played by Jefferson Mays, as the fussiest, most annoying person you can ever think to work with. He is great. So she brings all the ingredients for an omelet, borrows a hot plate, and uses her segment to cook the omelet on camera. And afterwards, she writes to Alice Naiman, played by Brittany Bradford, the only female producer on the show, to pitch herself as the host of a weekly cooking show, which is something no one has ever done before. Alice's boss, Russ, Fran Kranz, doesn't get it. He is also a frustrated theater director who thinks this job is beneath him, and he's frustrated also that all his very boring-sounding intellectual shows are not working, including the book one. But Alice and Julia push through with the help of Julia's best friend, Avis, played by Bebe Neuwirth, and her editor, Judith, played by Fiona Glascott. Back in New York, we also see Judith working with her boss, who's played by Judith Light, as, like, Mrs. Knopf of Knopf, and of course she's... So the show gets made, as we all know. I normally hate British people playing Americans and vice versa, so sidebar, Death on the Nile, which we also watched this weekend, was torture for me. But I digress. Given Julia's fancy pants American accent and her very distinctive voice, you don't really notice Lancashire sounding British at all because her voice is just strange.
She's so good. That's such good casting. I was like, I don't need this in my life. Oh, it's her. So, yeah.
Yeah. Also, if you were put off this by the marketing that said the creator used to work on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, don't worry. This is not a show celebrating anyone being obliviously insufferable. There are insufferable people, but the show knows that they are. And one of the things I said last week about The Girl from Plainville was that it made me feel awful. And while that's not the only criterion by which anyone should judge a show, Julia made me feel like I was wrapped in a snuggly blanket. All the performances are wonderful. For a show where the tensest moment in an episode might be an enophile watching as a guest puts ice in his expensive Bordeaux, which was actually got a gasp out of me. So if you need something to tide you over between episodes of Call the Midwife, this is the vibe. And it's even cozier because you can be pretty sure no episode is going to revolve around a newborn baby in distress. I famously don't cook or care about fancy food. I was absolutely rapt by this. I'd also say people who like British Bake Off, you would probably like this too. And the first three episodes dropped on HBO Max last week. There will be more every Thursday. And now my lowbrow shows. How We Roll was going to be the one I talked about. It's the new multi-cam sitcom on CBS in which Pete Holmes plays a version of Tom Smallwood, a real-life professional bowler. But the show is very average. Just reminds us that Pete Holmes is not an actor, no offense. Broadway star Julie White plays his mother and blows him off the screen. Totally slumming, speaking of slumming. But fortunately, I don't have to talk about that more because a listener named Jim emailed me last week to tell me that the show about trompe-l'oeil cakes that we wished we were watching instead of Is It Cake actually does exist. It is called Eye Candy. And here are the ways it's superior. Number one, the host is Josh Groban. He does not act like he's better than the material, possibly because he knows he's not a host, really. Number two, one thing at a time comes down a conveyor belt. Teams of two, one civilian and one very marginal celebrity, have to look at it from a reasonable distance and determine if it's edible. In the episode we watched, there was a bonsai tree, a roll of toilet paper, a yoga mat, and a disposable razor, for example. So then they hit a buzzer if they think it's edible. And then they don't cut the thing to see if they're right. They have to bite it. And some of those things aren't food, which is even funnier.
Wow.
So the first team to identify two edible things without getting three strikes gets to then go into a room, and in the pilot, it's two lanes of a bowling alley, and identify four cakes within the space without touching them. And then after they've picked, they then bite or try to bite them to see if they were right. This is exactly what Catherine suggested in her review, by the way. Mm-hmm. And that's it. The whole thing is done in well under 10 minutes because it was on Quibi. That's why no one's heard of it before.
Oh, Quibi, you did a thing.
R.I.P. Quibi.
I know. So the five lonely episodes they made before Quibi quibbed are now on the Roku channel. And sidebar, looking for this was the first time we ever engaged with the Roku channel. Talk about hostile architecture in terms of tech. You have to scroll through every fucking category they have before you can get to a search field. Fuck you. Anyway, speaking of fuck you, for my plug, I'm going to send you to, again with this, the podcast where Sarah and I are currently talking about Melrose Place, and also the Patreon for a It, which is at patreon.com/againwiththis. We have recently been talking about 21 Jump Street because Rob Estes was in it, Jenny Garth on The Larry Sanders Show. This week, it's going to be Courtney Thorne Smith's visit to mom. More fun stuff to come later this month. So check out all that at any level of support. You can get all of those bonus episodes, all close to 100. Good Lord.
Mm-hmm. Roxana, what do you got for us?
What I have been watching and enjoying a little bit more than I expected to is Tokyo Vice, which premieres on HBO Max on April 7th with 3 episodes. And I am a devoted Michael Mann admirer. I love him very much.
Oh, a Manny.
Yeah, a Manny. I think Tokyo Vice is sort of benefiting from being called Tokyo Vice. Mm-hmm. As Mann only directs the first episode. But I think that in general, the show, which is adapted from a memoir by reporter Jake Adelstein, I think it does hit that sort of Mann rhythm of tortured male leads, large scale problems involving the police and crime, and beautiful staring into the middle distance women who just mm-hmm. want to start over. And, you know, this show has all those things. It also must be discussed that it has Ansel Elgort, which is very not great, but the show only treats him as one of 4 leads, which I did not anticipate. So the general premise is that Elgort plays this reporter, Jake Adelstein, who moved to Japan, works very hard, and starts out on the crime beat on one of Japan's leading newspapers. And being, you know, the plucky American that he is, he doesn't understand why Japanese newspapers don't seem to investigate crime. They only report what the police say, and the police have sort of a tenuous peace with the Yakuza, or the organized crime syndicates in the country, to not necessarily report murders as murders. So he sets off on investigating why this is and trying to understand a recent uptick in suicides, and then in doing so meets an array of Japanese characters who are far more interesting than he is and better actors than Elgort is. And that's really when the show seems to come to life. I really think that it is Ken Watanabe's show, and he is perfect as this police detective who finally decides, like, enough is enough, and it's time to sort of break whatever relationship the police and the Yakuza have, potentially for the betterment of the country at large. And there's some sort of naivete to that idea that I think the show does a good job puncturing. It, like Moon Knight, I think takes a little while to get going mm-hmm. because I think there's so many storylines that they're trying to set up that are then in conversation with each other that I think it requires some patience. And it does require tolerating Elgort, which might be a deal breaker for some people, and I understand if it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were thinking about reviewing that this week for my true crime newsletter, Best Evidence, and Elgort was a speed bump for sure.
Yeah, and it's hard because the first episode is very much about him mm-hmm. because he's the entry into this world.
Yeah,
right. But I think once you get past him, the rest of the Japanese cast is so interesting, and they're doing so many more difficult character portrayals that he sort of fades mm-hmm. into the background.
Okay, well, good. That's a
relief. Right? I mean, good. That's all can be said. Good.
Fading is something he needs to do.
But, yeah.
It also makes you wonder, though, if like the season was structured differently and then some editing decisions were made after certain revelations came out.
Yes.
Yeah. I do wonder because he does sort of take a backseat. So that has been something that I have been watching and enjoying. I also have been rewatching 30 Rock in full, which I don't think I ever did linearly. And that is on Hulu, and it is very bizarre how prescient that show is in terms of how we watch TV now. Mm-hmm. So that has been something that I have been enjoying. And something that I would suggest that you check out is just that Vulture, which is where I'm a TV critic, is doing an array of themed weeks this month. We're starting off with Erotic Thrillers Week, and then moving into Sequels Week. So if you were so inclined, you could check out some of those pieces at vulture.com.
We will also link to your Twitter and to your author page at Vulture as well.
Cool. Thanks.
Sarah Day, buddy.
I am here to talk about the Andy Warhol Diaries. That is Netflix's 6-part series. It came out last month. How much you get out of it is probably going to depend on two things. A, how important you think Andy Warhol is and was as a meta commentator on American fame and secular sainthood, and a bleeding edge example of the artist as brand and the self as an evolving work. And B, how creepy you find the AI version of his voice, which was approved by the Andy Warhol Foundation and is a slurry of things Warhol actually said on a mic and read snippets of the diaries performed by Bill Irwin. It is disorienting, but it also reflects a lot of what the docuseries is trying to get at about the edited reality of self, how icons work against intimacy, so on and so forth. I'm sort of fascinated by Warhol as a person as well as an artist. I really enjoyed marinating in this over the course of a couple days. It's both painstaking in places, and it seems to skip over things or not exactly be able to bring itself to dig into them in terms of Warhol's intimate relationships. It spends a lot of time on his collaborations with Basquiat and probably should just have been about that and about the tug of war between their styles, effacement versus defacement. Sidebar, I was not an art major. What I don't know about 20th century art is almost everything. I just happen to have read a lot about Warhol's factory and various personae who figured there. So that's how I tend to come at him as a persona versus a painter. But then again, the series is devoted to unpacking every single bag of that dichotomy, and I'm not sure it ever quite finds what it's looking for, but I think that's also kind of the point of the series and of Warhol, that there is no answer. There's just like shifting sands, kind of. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. You can't beat the visuals. And the score and the Bill Irwin AI VO give it this loneliness that I thought was good. Like I was sort of watching it on a cloudy day in Massachusetts and it was like, after each episode, I don't know, like that can be a good thing. It's not like Girl from Plainville makes you feel terrible. It's just like, you know, steeped in rue.
Makes you feel melancholy. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Melancholy. Perfect word. Series director Andrew Rossi has been a producer on Aaron Lee Carr projects like Mommy, Dead and Dearest and I Love You Now Die, the Michelle Carter documentary. He has directed some other stuff. It feels to me like maybe this needed another couple of meetings just to try to find one aspect of Warhol's life and larger symbology that Rossi could really dig in on. Anyway, my point here is that I don't know whether anyone else is necessarily going to like it, but I can tell you that within 15 minutes, either you're going to be like sort of lulled into boredom or sleep or captivated by it. So it's not like a upfront investment of that much time to figure out whether you should keep watching. Andy Warhol Diaries, that is on Netflix. And if you own the book, it's an excellent doorstop and sort of a cool look into mid-century New York and the art scene. For my plug, America's Damp 40, Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs is back, and we're making a chart out of the moistest pop songs of all time. You can vote and help us determine the fate of, among other songs, Cool Night, Chevy Van. You can go to patreon.com/mastass and vote, see the charts as they're evolving from week to week. We would love your support, but voting and updates are free to all for this season of Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, so check it out. Again, that's patreon.com/mastass, and you can subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
Coming up on the next Extra Extra Hot Great, it is Sarah makes everyone watch the Jump the Shark episode of Happy Days. We've all talked
Sorry.
About it, but who among us has ever watched it? Not I. Mm-mm. Not I. Mm-mm. That is available to all supporters at any level at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, we welcome back Dan Concito to watch what I'm sure is going to be the excellent U.S. version of Would I Lie to You? Yes, another panel show import. maybe he'll surprise us. Who's to say? We'll find out next week right
one
here.
One of these on has to work, right?
EHG Prime. It is time for the extra hot great canon. This week, we toss it over to Laura, who will pitch for The Righteous Gemstones Season 2, Episode 4, as to how they may destroy him. Take it away, Laura.
Hi, I'm here today to pitch Season 2, Episode 4 of The Righteous Gemstones for induction into the extra hot great canon. This episode really centers around the increasing tension between Eli and each of his children, as he doesn't seem to give in to their demands, one of which is flying muscle-bound apostles to Israel for a recreation of Jesus' 40 days in the desert. Another one is investing in a Zion-themed water park with other megachurch leaders. But there are two storylines that I think make this episode canon-worthy. I'd like to start with the first one that centers around Uncle Baby Billy. This episode actually starts in a mall in 1993, and as someone whose first mall job started in December of 1993, I can attest to the accuracy of the art direction, wardrobes, and sets. And yes, there actually were pet stores in the mall that sold live animals, which is exactly what Uncle Baby Billy, his wife, and his son Harmon are doing, because Uncle Baby Billy states that Harmon is going to need a pet after this Christmas. As you enjoy the early 90s nostalgia, with Walden books in the background, an offer to go to Chess King, Uncle Baby Billy layers it on with a final gift to his son, here in clip one.
I will always be your daddy. Always. Just like these genuine pair of Oakleys. There is no substitute for the original. You hear me? Come here. Oh, yeah. You got the goods, boy. I love you, son.
It seems implausible that someone who lavishes so much affection on their son and appears to genuinely love him would then just turn, walk out of the mall, and walk out of his child's life. But that's exactly what Uncle Baby Billy does. When we catch up with Uncle Baby Billy in current day, he is more tan than ever, wearing light-colored suits so that orange skin pops right out. And he is performing at BJ's baptism, heard here in clip two.
When this poor lisping, stammering tongue lies silent in the grave, then in a nobler, sweeter song, I'll sing thy power to save.
Ah, amen, amen. Thank you. That's off my brand new hip album, Lightning Round. In stores everywhere, also available for download. Wow.
The awfulness of Uncle Baby Billy cannot be disputed, but the awfulness of promoting his album at a baptism is why we love him on our TV. Nothing sums up this love, hate, laugh, disgust phenomenon than this charming story he tells about his 9-month pregnant wife in clip three.
My mama didn't have none of that stuff when I was born.
Yeah, but you was a toilet baby.
Oh, yeah.
A who what?
A toilet baby. See, Tiffany's mom was obese. Went through her entire pregnancy without even knowing she was pregnant. Ended up pushing this one out when she sat down to do her bathroom business, just like, Tiff just plopped down like a little old turd, just right down in a bowl, big eyes like this.
But it wasn't a turd, it was me.
That was you.
This feeling that you have right here of laughing, loving how hard you're laughing, but also hating everything that you heard and everybody who said it, and knowing that the characters are really, truly awful is really one of my favorite parts of The Righteous Gemstones. And even up until the very end of this episode, Uncle Baby Billy has abandoned his wife without saying anything, who, as I mentioned before, is 9 months pregnant. We hope that he is driving off to make amends with Harmon, but we also know that there's an equal shot of him just leaving his current wife and the unborn child. The other canon worry storyline also features a character who I love, but I really only love her because she is so awful, and that is Judy Gemstone. Today is her big day, as her husband, BJ, will finally be baptized. And there's only one dark cloud in her way. We'll set this up in clip four.
Your family's so fucking tedious to deal with, BJ.
Tedious?
only visit like once a year.
Still, it's too much. This is not what I envisioned for myself, in-laws. I always thought I would marry an orphan with a dead family so I didn't have to deal with this shit.
To be clear, BJ's family is lovely. However, they are secular progressives from Asheville, and Judy spends the entire episode relentlessly railing against them. Even in the song that she sings when BJ, wearing his nose plugs, enters a massive cross-shaped baptismal font. Listen here in clip 5.
Butterflies, butterflies, they start as caterpillars. And the caterpillars, they change into butterflies. That's why Jesus died, to take all of our earthly sins away. When a man outgrows the family of his origin, and they've no place in his life, 'cause he's different now. He's got to show them how. They need to see and just go away. Butterflies.
She is a toxic, manipulative narcissist, and I can't get enough. She manipulates BJ into getting angry with his family because they don't seem to take his double-breasted romper with cummerbund and bow tie, possibly made out of crushed velvet, seriously as a fashion choice. And eventually, Judy confronts BJ's sister, aptly named KJ, in the reception hall bathroom, here in clip 6.
My brothers hate BJ too.
Why do your brothers hate BJ?
Duh, because he took my ass off the market, bitch. Jesse and Kelvin might be my brothers, but that don't mean they're not sitting up in their rooms at night thinking someday they might get to hook up with me.
Ew, Judy, that's disgusting.
I didn't say I was gonna do it, okay? I don't know how a man's mind works.
I would never want to hook up with BJ.
You're telling me you would not want to fuck your fine-ass brother?
No, I really wouldn't.
Okay. What if I got a big old gun and I put it right to your head and I said, ooh, KJ, I'm gonna kill you unless you get nude right now in this living room and fuck your brother in front of me. Then would you fuck him?
I mean, if you were gonna kill me.
See? I knew it. I knew it. Don't be jealous, KJ. Your brother is mine. Stop fighting me for him.
It is ridiculous. It is uncomfortable. And it is hilarious. This is the holy trinity of Righteous Gemstones humor. I think based solely on this, the episode is canon worthy. But I'd like to present just a couple of bonus tip-ins about this episode that I think help it to rise above some of its others. Number one, aspects of Danny McBride's humor that are most off-putting are not present in this episode. There's no puking. There are no balls. And the only penis we see is on a horse statue. Next, we get to hear John Goodman singing Misbehavin' to himself. So we get to enjoy that return of that earworm. And finally, Eli is getting less bottled up as we see him in season 2. And this allows John Goodman to do things like give an insincere apology to a Hulk Hogan-ish goon in jorts. In conclusion, I hope that I was able to convince at least 2 little country kids outside Misbehavin' to vote yes on episode 4, season 2 of The Righteous Gemstones into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
I was considering editing that last part, but then it grew on me, and I found it incredibly endearing that
it's
she
the sound
the
of
title.
Leafing. That
yes,
is very
this is what
relatable.
It takes. You have to be prepared.
Relatable. It's a big, long title.
That's right. Thank you, Laura. Roxana, you chose us from our list of submissions. Please start us off.
I vote yes. I love this show so much. Everything about it. And I think this episode for me is the highlight of season 2. I think for all of the reasons and clips listed here, it is such a good switch to these sort of secondary characters that we see in the background a lot. Mm-hmm. We love Uncle Baby Billy because he's absurd. We love BJ because he's absurd. But Righteous Gemstones is always operating at the layer underneath that silliness, mm-hmm. and whatever human emotions of fear and selfishness and wanting to belong and wanting to be loved drive your worst actions. Yeah. And I think that this episode does that so well. I mean, the ostentatiousness of the baptism, the fact that it is this gigantic party for someone who was doubting whether he actually wanted to do this. I just think all the performances are really perfect. And as much as I think that the writing on this show is great, and so much of the clips were being prefaced with the fact that, like, this is hilarious, it's hilariously written. Mm-hmm. But it's really the line deliveries and performances that make them funny, I think.
Yeah.
So the thing about that Judy and KJ scene is that I think Judy at some point licks her face. Yeah, like, they're all those little, they're all those little flourishes that take it right up to the edge before dialing it back. And for me, at least, I always end a Righteous Gemstones episode thinking, like, I really, truly hate these people.
Yeah.
But I do want them to be happy. And I think that this episode does that really well.
All right, Sarah, why don't you go next, and then Dave and I will close up since we watched more of this.
I did not care for this show when we first talked about it, and I still don't. I don't agree that it dials it back in time. I don't agree that it cares about the people that it's talking about. Like, I did laugh a couple of times at this, and I think that some of the performances, especially BJ, John Baltz, is that his name?
Tim Baltz.
Tim Baltz.
His delivery of, it isn't just about separates, and just the physical comedy that he's doing, like destroying and then re-putting on his romper. I mean, it's genius. Walton Goggins is really good. And I think he does sort of convey the complexity of this character and this situation. But there's just something about the show's attitude towards itself that, like, I just can't. Like, these are scabrously terrible people to spend any time with. And it's unrelenting. And my issue with it, I think, is that when the quiet part is out loud every time, all the time, then, like, I can't rest. Like, mentally, narratively, I don't know. This might just be a me thing, but I think that the show still has not decided whether it wants to burn all of these people to the ground or give us a humorous look at a heightened world in which they actually exist. I mean, I was confirmed via full immersion, like, this shit happens in the American Baptist Conference, I am sad to tell you. So, I want to like the show, and I'm always almost there. And then it just, like, I don't know, like, it gives me a titty twister at the end of the scene and is like, fuck you too. Like, so with that said, excellent presentation, and I understand why this episode would be considered canon worthy compared with its brethren. I'm not sure I'm there. I definitely didn't want to keep going with the show, but she did mention a lot of the things that I had written down as high points. And I think it's worth. It did sort of force me to look at, like, why exactly do you find this show so off-putting? And I think I cracked the code, so I guess that's worth something. But this was not an enjoyable 38 minutes for me. I kind of felt every one of them. Good presentation, though. And Misbehaving stuck in my head again.
I'll go next. I think it's fine if this is not for you. Certainly nothing else Danny McBride has ever done in his career has been for me either. Like, this one is for some reason. And I think it's the performances that are around him that he's not really at this. I mean, he's sort of at the center of it, but the center sort of switches. And I do think that part of what makes this one extraordinary, or, you know, makes it stand out in the season, is that it really is a story turning point, and it sets up, like, the back half of season two in a bunch of different ways, with the Harmon story, but also with the Eli story. And Laura's right that this, it comes at a time of increasing tension between Eli and all his shitty kids. And like, they each get a turn at the baptism party, like trying to come at him, and him just being like, what is wrong with you? Like, there's a couple of ways too that this episode, where characters are kind of like commenting on the action, and certainly BJ's family are almost audience stand-ins for where they like, oh, this is how a normal person would react if they were in the company right. of the Gemstones for real. But Eli is also almost there. Like he's starting to really hate all his shitty kids and the difficulty that he is having in being just in their company since his wife's death is really getting more stark at this point in his plot line. And, you know, culminating in him breaking both of Calvin's thumbs in front of a huge crowd. It's like, he kind of had to do it. Like, it just does feel inevitable when you get to that moment. It's like, he had to. And what Sarah doesn't know is that this was set up in an earlier episode this season, that Eli used to be a wrestler. And so that [S2] Right. [S1] that was one of his moves, which is also what makes, I think, the scene in the parking lot with the the crappy Hulk Hogan Monkey heel also very funny. That, you know, I've said this before, it's nice to see John Goodman acting, because I also watched The Conners, where I'm pretty sure he's reading cue cards, whereas this is, you know, him giving an actual performance.
Yeah. It does seem like he's in a different show, though.
Well, that's the thing.
You know?
Yeah. And there's that sort of, like, ebbs and flows over the course of the season with all of the characters.
But that's more like, that's like a generational take on where they are mm-hmm. in relation yeah. to the business that they have. Like right. Eli grew it. He's there. He takes it a certain pride in it. And it means something different to him than does yes. his children, which is like, it's more of a meal ticket kind of thing.
And, for sure. Yeah. And this is why people compare it to Succession as well, mm-hmm. where he's the one who built this church. And now all his shitty kids are like, you know, crabs trying to crawl right. over each other out of the bucket to get to it. And none of them is really worthy. And yeah. they're all stupid idiots. Especially Judy. I mean, she's, you know, Roxana, you interviewed her this mm-hmm. during this season. Like, her performance is so transcendently horrible. Like, Edie Patterson never sells out this character at all. She is committed 5,000% to just being so awful. And her and Tim Baltz as a comedy team are like, the casting people every time they watch this show must just pat themselves on the back for putting mm-hmm. them together, because they really,
and they should,
they are great together. And you know, I'm not sure I agree with Laura that the Barneses are perfectly lovely. They seem like they're shitty in their way too, but I do think they're important for the episode, as I said, to sort of be almost the norm of the satire, of like showing us this is a heightened situation, and a normal person thrust into it would be extremely put off for all of the obvious reasons, you know? So, yeah, I, you know, this is definitely not a show for everyone, for sure. But I do think this episode is important on its face, and also in the context of the season. Dave.
Yeah. I love good shows about successful, inept assholes. And I think that's what this show does really well, is this is a showcase for those characters. Now, if that puts you off on the base level, I'm never going to be able to sell you on this. I'm never going to be able to sell you on Veep. I'm never going to be able [S2] Right. [S1] To sell you on The Thick of It. I think this, even though we have Veep, is actually the closest thing to an American Armando Iannucci show.
Yes.
It really does.
And it's also super American, because it's a phenomenon that doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Outside this
That's what I
yes.
mean. Like, yeah. like Veep right. was sort of a translation of The Thick of It.
Yeah.
Whereas this seems like it's just this nice big American version of what you do. And I get it if you don't like it. I mean, it really is. I often say about how much I enjoy assholes on TV, but the ebb and flow of everything, of their fortunes and each individual kid and how they deal with their place in the hierarchy, whether they feel loved enough, while they at once also try to undermine Eli and everything he does. Like, it's if it was something that you experienced, or even just sort of like by proxy saw in real life, it would put a bad taste in your mouth. And if you can't extract entertainment out of that, I get it. I can. I love this stuff. More, please. Yum, 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 yum. And this episode, to me, really is the highlight of season 2. And The one knock against this episode, and it is generally just the weakest point in season two, is I just don't like the strong man storyline. I didn't think it really went anywhere. Yeah, they're sort of what are the actual real ones called?
Oh, Pam talked about it.
Oh, I don't remember what the real ones are called.
It's like this is the bodybuilders for Jesus.
Yes.
Thing. Yeah.
And that just never really goes anywhere, and it's very siloed in its impact to the whole season. And I just felt like they sort of built this storyline for season two, and then they kind of, oh shit, what about that one kid? We forgot. We got to do something for him.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah, strong episode. Just like really delicious, terrible person episode of television for me. I really think Righteous Gemstones, even though it is lauded, I feel like it's still kind of under the radar show.
Yeah.
For how good it is.
One more thing I wanted to add that I forgot to mention when it was my turn before was the one scene with the Listens, the other megachurch couple that are trying to get Jesse and his wife Amber to buy in on this resort. When they find out they can't afford it, there's just every line in that scene hit for me. Eric Andre as the male Listen being like, but your family's worth $600 million. I looked it up on Bing. Like, a Bing mention is always going to get me. And then when they're leaving, yeah, and then his wife is like, can you cover this? Two drinks. I think the peanuts are free, like just implying that they're too poor to even pick up the check at this axe throwing place is great. And finally, I can't believe that Laura didn't ask you to clip Uncle Baby Billy commenting on Harmon saying, oh, he a cat boy, because that's a cat boy. if ever there was one.
Yeah.
He a cat Uncle boy, Baby, for sure.
Uncle Baby Billy calling BJ TJ.
Yes!
While performing at his baptism.
Yes. Yeah, Walter Goggins feels like he's like, I feel like he could do it for scale. You know, he really seems like he's having so much fun doing it. He really sells that character really well.
Yeah.
All right, let's put this to the official vote. Roxana, what say you? Canon worthy or not?
Canon worthy.
Sarah Diamante.
No thanks, but good presentation.
Tara?
Yay.
And yay for me. So that means Righteous Gemstones Season 2, Episode 4, as to how they may destroy him. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Ray Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time to talk about the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I sure do. And it's Naomi Watts, but it's also Grandpa Bunsey. Naomi Watts will be starring and producing in season two of Feud about, quote, Capote's women. I just finished an audiobook on this, which was narrated by someone with an extremely plummy accent. I'm sort of obsessed with this aspect of Capote's life and times. And like Babe Paley and why she was, and these people that were called The Ultimate by Harper's Bazaar. Like, it just is like a, not just another time, but like another planet to me. I love reading about it. I can't wait to see what Feud does with it. It's going to give me an excuse to binge watch the first outing. And I'm really glad it's back. I'm really glad they're doing something else with it. And I'm glad that it's Naomi Watts because she's rad.
And loser of the week?
Loser of the week is potentially the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, a.k.a. the AMPTP, because the BC division of the Directors Guild of Canada is seeking its first ever strike vote. And secondarily, the loser is every fucking sci-fi fantasy genre show that shoots in Vancouver, which is all of them. So this really could cripple the industry if it actually gets into a protracted fight. So go, directors. Get yours.
Speaking about getting yours, you know what time it is?
It's game time.
All right, everybody. This is the third game time of the season. The scores are Value Guess with one, Tar with one, Sarah still looking to get on the board. Today, we are playing Relativity from Meredith S., who earns herself an extra credit topic. In Relativity, I will give you the names of two TV actors who have both played children to a common parent actor.
Okay.
You name the common parent actor and the two shows in question. 1 point for each correct piece of the puzzle. Let me give you an example. Alexis Bledel and Mae Whitman are your two actors. Now, they have both played children to what other actor?
Lauren Graham.
In?
Gilmore Girls and Parenthood.
That would give you the full 3 points for that question. Okay. So today there's going to be no stealing and there's no vampirism because we're welcome back the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone after a hiatus.
Ooh,
so I don't want to confuse everybody with too many rules. So let's just go straight to Piggy to see who's going to go first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, let's go. Sarah, Roxana, Tara, are we ready to play Relativity?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, your two actors that played kids are Jason Alexander and Leah Remini.
Okay, Jason Alexander and Leah Remini shared a parent in Mr. Jerry Stiller, R.I.P.
We miss him.
On Seinfeld and the King of Queens.
King of Queens is correct. That is 3 full points on your first question. All right, Roxana. Christina Applegate and Jesse Tyler Ferguson both played children to what actor?
I mean, I can't remember his name.
I will ding you on anything you get right. You may guess it in any order you want.
I know it was Married with Children and Modern Family. But
there's 2 points.
I cannot, for the life of me, remember Al Bundy's real name. It's not going to come to me.
All right.
Give me my 2 points.
You got 2 points. That's pretty good. We'll buzz you on the last one. The last one is Ed O'Neill. Ed O'Neill.
Right.
Ed, come on.
All right, Tara, your first pair of children actors are Peter Krause and Neil Patrick Harris.
Okay, shit. Oh, no, I've got it. Peter Krause's dad in 6 Feet Under was Richard Jenkins. And I think he also played Neil Patrick Harris's dad in How I Met Your Mother.
All right, we're going to give you 2 points. You did mention the shows, both 6 Feet Under and How I Met Your Mother. Wrong parent, Frances Conroy.
Frances Conroy!
Oh!
Oh, shit.
Right.
Never would have come to me.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, back to you. Vincent D'Onofrio and Justina Machado.
Oh, right. Okay. God, I forgot about this. So the D'Onofrionics occurred on Law & Order Criminal Intent. His mom was played by Rita Moreno, who also played Justina Machado's mom on One Life to Live. No, One Day at a Time.
Yes, One Day at a Time is correct. Yes, full 3 for Sarah there. Correct.
Your brain. My God.
This is very rare.
I could hear it.
Please come back every week. This is great.
Let's go inside of Sarah's brain.
Yeah, don't.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. All right. Oh, Roxana, your two actors who both play children to a common third actor are H. John Benjamin and Tony Hale.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's Jessica Walter, right? And it's Arrested Development and Archer.
Yes. Full 3 points.
Gorgeous.
And... R.I.P. Jessica.
Yes.
Ron Howard. Edward Herman.
Oh, it's... Oh, no. What's her name? It's Marion Ross. Fuck. She played Ron Howard's mother in Happy Days, and she played Edward Herman's mother in Gilmore Girls.
Yes. Full 3 there. Nicely done.
Nice.
Back to Sarah. Lena Dunham. John Francis Daly.
Well, shit. Okay. Lena Dunham. Oh, my God. Fuck, what is her name? Okay, so it was in Girls. And in Freaks and Geeks.
Yep.
In which Becky Baker.
You got to hear that. It's Becky Ann, but
Becky Ann Baker, but we'll take that. Good for your full
Hell
3.
Yeah.
Roxana. Tyler James Williams and Marcel Spears.
Nothing about this is going to literally
I'm going to take a stab at the shows.
No.
I think it's a tough one.
Like, it's vaguely in my brain, uh-huh. but not enough to ever materialize.
Do you want to just name two shows in the history of television? Who knows?
No. Yeah.
No, doesn't want to do that. All right, we'll buzz you. Anybody know any part of that?
No, I mean, I don't know who Marcel Spears is, so I don't know which Tyler James Williams character it is.
All right. The shows we are talking about are Everybody Hates Chris.
Okay.
Damn it.
And The Neighborhood.
That's what I was thinking of. Never would have gone The Neighborhood, but something in my mind was like, Chris. And then I was like, are you just thinking about the Oscars?
So it's Tatiana Arnold.
That's correct, yes.
Ugh. All right.
No points there, but still plenty of to go.
Nothing about that either.
All right. Tara.
Yep.
Jean Triplehorn.
Yep.
Allison Janney.
Ellen Burstyn played Jean Triplehorn's mother in Big Love and Allison Janney's mother in Mom.
Yes. Full three there. Back to Buncey with June Diane Raphael and Elizabeth Moss.
Elizabeth Moss. what are some shows in which Elizabeth Moss had parents? Those must have been good shows. Let's guess that it was. Did we ever see her parents in that show? Let's try The Handmaid's Tale.
Okay, then I
don't know the rest of it. Sorry.
Is it Mad Men?
No, it's not Mad Men. It's earlier.
Oh, God.
Oh.
All right. What do you think, Tara?
Well, it's The West Wing.
Yep.
Who's the other person?
June Diane Raphael.
Okay, so that's Martin Sheen plays her dad in Grace and Frankie.
That's right. Yeah, all three pieces of the puzzle. Martin Sheen, Grace and Frankie, The West Wing.
God, The West Wing.
I thought for sure it was because Cherry Jones plays her mother in The Handmaid's Tale.
That's right.
Of course it's going to be her. She's played other moms.
All right, to Roxanna, we got Frankie Muniz and RJ Mitty.
Is it Cranston?
It is Cranston, Bryan.
Malcolm in the Middle.
Yes, all three.
Okay.
Nice.
All right, this is for Tara. We'll take us into our mid-game score break.
Okay.
Your actors are Sally Struthers and Helen Hunt.
Oh, God. Carol O'Connor played Sally Struthers' dad in All in the Family. And he was one of three different actors to play Jamie's father in Mad About You.
Correct.
Nice.
Yes.
Woo.
Nicely done. All right. That is halfway. So let's hear the score start.
You guys, it's so close. Roxanna has 8. Sarah has 9. I have 11.
Nice. I distinctly remember losing last time. And it's an honor, truly.
You're doing great. Everyone is having a very strong game.
All right, Roxanna, that means you are in the Gross Source Equalizer Challenge. Oh.
Ooh, good luck! It's been a while, Lisa.
All right, Roxanna, that means you are in the Gross Source Equalizer Challenge Zone. It's been a while, so let me remind you how it works. I have your choice of 3 TV Trivial Pursuit sets to choose from. I can give you the old ancient TV set from the mid-80s. I can give you the 90s themed or the Pop Culture 2 themed cards to choose from. I will read you 6 TV questions. If you get 3 of them right, you will get 2 points. If you get all of them right, if you sweep the card, we'll double that to 4. So you have your choice, old, 90s, or just kind of a general Pop Culture 2, which is the most recently published one.
Let's do Pop Culture 2.
Good choice, Pop Culture 2. Okay. Here we go.
Good luck. Good luck.
Okay. So much pressure.
Here we go. What newswoman landed a cameo as a prison guard in Austin Powers in Goldmember? TV newswoman.
I'm just gonna guess. I mean, part of me wants to say Katie Couric, but part of me also wants to say Connie Chung. I'm gonna go with
Katie Couric.
Oh no.
What exclamation is typically written into Simpsons scripts as annoyed grunt? What exclamation is typically written into Simpsons scripts just as annoyed grunt?
Is it just dough?
Dough is correct.
Okay. Ooh, man. All right.
What managed to stay in its proper orbit on September 13th, 1999, much to the chagrin of expectant Space 1999 fans? What stayed in its proper orbit on September 13th, 1999, much to the chagrin of Space 1999 fans?
A comet of some kind?
I have no idea.
The moon.
Oh, I thought it was either the moon or Earth.
Okay.
What series narrowly escaped being titled Alley Cats or Harry's Angels?
Charlie's Angels?
Charlie's Angels, correct.
You only need to get one more.
Two more questions. You only need one to get your 2 points.
Oh, no.
What show challenges contestants to play games like Cliffhangers, High Low, and Swap Meet?
Not Price is Right. No. Yes. No.
Is that an answer?
Yes. Price is Right. But right. I think it's wrong.
That really smelled like a stream of consciousness. The answer is Price is Right.
Yes,
good.
It is.
And it is correct. Yes.
Yay.
Okay. Add 2 points to Woo! Roxana's total as we play the back half of the game. Back to Sarah D. Bunting.
Man.
To remind you, two actors both played kids to what third actor? Lisa Kudrow, Alana Glazer.
Okay, so Alana Glazer was on Broad City, and Lisa Kudrow was on Friends, and I assume it's some actor in common. I don't know.
You are correct on those 2 points, so you get 2 points for the shows, but no points for
Balaban.
All right, Roxana. Adrian Barbeau and Scott Jacoby.
No. Nothing about that. No. I don't even know who those people are.
Oh, yeah. That's a tough one.
We're going back in time for that one, I believe.
Okay.
Anybody
I would
want
just
to take
blind
a
guess, like Jason Robards? Like, who's older than Adrian Barbeau?
No. Sarah, any idea here?
I mean, I think Jacoby was Parker Lewis Can't Lose, but beyond that, I got nothing.
Common actor, B. Arthur, from Maude and the Golden Girls.
Okay.
Oh, right.
All right, Mason Cook, yep. Benjamin Stockham.
Okay. Well, the only thing I know Mason Cook from is Speechless. So I'm going to guess the mom is Minnie Driver. And I don't know who the other person is, so I don't have a guess.
Benjamin Stockman from About a Boy TV show.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah, that thing.
All right. Oh.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Decker with 2 Ks, in case that makes a difference to you. And Jack Gleason.
With 2 E's.
Jack?
With 2 E's, yes. Thomas Decker, 2 Ks, Jack Gleason, 2 E's.
I think that's Benson and Benson the college years, and the common person is Jackie Mason. I don't know these people.
Very close. Anybody know any part of that?
Thomas Decker's from Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Oh, yeah.
Correct.
The other kid is Game of Thrones.
That's right.
So it's Cersei Lannister, and
yes.
I can't remember her
Lena
name.
Headley.
Lena Headey.
Yes. All those things were correct. Yeah, Jack Gleason's a little shit king, right?
Yeah.
Little shit king.
little shit king.
Could you narrow it down a little? That's
how it's credited. In the credits. They roll up. It says,
it's official.
Jackie, as the little shit king. This is question 17.
The spread eagle.
It is for Roxana. Adam Brody, Jane Levy. Adam Brody and Jane Levy. They are two actors that both played kids to what other actor on television?
This is probably wrong, but I feel like it's OC and the singing show.
You know I can't ding you on that, but I want to. I will say you're on the right track. No, I'll give you that.
And I feel like, is it Peter Gallagher?
It is. Now you want to revisit that last show?
Oh, what is the singing show?
What is the singing show?
It's not going to come to me, but it's a singing show.
The singing show is Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have guessed that singing show. That's why I'm in last.
Pretty good. You got 2 points out of it, though.
Okay.
Yep.
Chris Lowell.
Yep.
Ali Grant are your two actors.
I don't know who Ally Grant is. But, oh, yes, I do. Okay. This is Elizabeth Perkins. She played Chris Lowe's mom in Glow, R.I.P. And Ally Grant is from Weeds.
Yes. 3 points.
Damn.
Nicely done.
Nice.
Wow. Time for question 19. 19. Sarah Dee Bunting, we need to know about Jake Lacy and Helene York.
Do I?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I do. I do, in fact. These names sound familiar, and yet, Jake Lacy. Yeah, no. New York. No. Well, let's just, for fun, for everyone's entertainment, pretend Jake Lacy is the child of Cagney and Lacy's Lacy, so the mom is Ty Daly.
Is it? It's not White Lotus, is it?
White Lotus is one of the shows.
Yep.
Molly Shannon?
Yep.
Molly Shannon. Okay. So the other show is?
The other two.
The other two, yes. Oh, Molly yeah. Shannon, White Lotus, okay. The other two.
Sorry, Jake Lacy and Helene York.
All right, Roxana, Ellie Kemper, Mae Martin.
I have no idea who Mae Martin is, so I'm going to just guess Kimmy Schmidt.
That's one of the items.
I have no memory of who played her parents.
When I tell you, you're going to know.
Yeah, just tell me. Tell me.
When all right, the other you. Show is called Feel Good.
Feel Good.
Okay.
Right.
And
okay.
The mother to Kimmy Schmidt is Lisa Kudrow.
Ah!
Right.
Bringing See? It back to
You know
Kudrow.
It now, don't you?
Full circle. Yeah. All right.
Tara.
Yeah.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Right.
Josh O'Connor.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge, let's say Fleabag. Oh, okay, I've got it now. Josh O'Connor, it's the common parent is Olivia Colman, and she was Josh O'Connor's mother in The Crown.
Yes, correct. All right, everybody's last question coming at you, so let's get them scores quick, please, Tara.
Okay, well, I have 19. Roxana has 13. Sarah Dee Bunting has 11.
All right, let's finish it up. Everybody's got one last one. Go out in a blaze of glory, Sarah Dee Bunting. Sean Hayes, Tracy Ellis Ross.
Okay. Will and Grace?
Why not? Good for one.
Blackish?
Good for two.
Don't know the common parent.
You
Enjoy.
Never would get this in a billion years. No.
What
it's
is it?
Bo Bridges.
What?
What?
Yeah.
You are actually, like, fast forward a million years. Me yeah. still being, like, naming people who aren't even born yet.
You never
Benji.
Would. you could look it up on IMDb and just think... They have to be wrong.
Yeah, no, it'll just slide off my brain and trickle.
All right, Roxana, here comes your last question. We've got Kate Winslet and Caitlin Olsen.
Kate Winslet and Caitlin Olsen.
Yes.
And these are only TV credits, right? This isn't someone who played Kate Winslet's mom in a movie.
Yeah, all TV.
Okay.
I mean,
although
I don't know.
They don't have to be a series, right?
Right.
We've had some.
Okay.
Miniseries.
I mean, part of me wants to say Jean Smart, which might be wrong. But I'm trying to think of Kate Winslet TV, and I can only think of, like, Mayor of Easttown. I don't know.
Why you just say something? Maybe something you already said.
That's what I'll say. I'll say
Jean
Mayor of Easttown, and I'll say
right, we'll give you a point
Smart.
For Jean Smart. We're going to give you a point for Mayor of Easttown, because I heard Mayor of Easttown.
Maybe the Mick. I don't know.
The Mick. Oh,
that would be great.
Nope, it is
R.I.P. the Mick.
Hacks.
Oh, yeah.
Plays her daughter on Hacks.
Whatever. Get out of here, Hacks.
Yeah. All right. Tara.
Yes.
All right, Tara. Ellen Pompeo.
Yep.
Zoe Perry. Zoe Perry.
Who the hell are her parents on that show? I'm gonna guess. Oh, it's Jeff Perry, of course. Is Zoe Perry's dad probably in something, and
correct.
Ellen Pompeo's dad in Grey's Anatomy.
All right, Grey's
what
Anatomy.
Would the other show be? Young Sheldon?
Scandal.
That's his real daughter.
Oh, wow.
All right, that's regulation. Let's hear the final score, please.
Everyone performed well. Sarah Dee Bunting finished with 13. Roxana had 15. I'm barely ahead, 21.
All right, that is it, but let's do the tiebreaker. First person to give me the common actor's name will win a little goodie for future use. Your two actors are Patrick Wilson, Alexander Skarsgård.
Meryl Streep?
Meryl Streep, yes.
Hey!
That is Angels in America and Big Little Lies.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Sarah Bunte. Nice little bonus there, but today belongs to Tara.
Yes, it does.
Tara.
Woo, thank you very much. Fun game.
Yes.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We discussed the ebb and flow of Marvel's Moon Knight before going around the dial with stops at Julia, How We Roll, kind of, Eye Candy, Tokyo Vice, and the Andy Warhol Diaries. Have you heard the good news? Laura got the Righteous Gemstones as How They May Destroy Him into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Meredith. Next up, Fonz jumps the shark on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, it's the CW version of What I Lie to You. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Funyuns,
oh, Sarah D. Bunting,
I looked it up on Bing,
and Roxana Haddadi.
I don't even know what we're doing anymore.
No. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Listen, if you don't stop nattering at me, I swear I'll shove you in a sarcophagus. You can tell the bloody pharaoh in there what's wrong with him and all. Go on.
Okay. Just as an aside, it was nice to see the return of the some schlub owns giant weird shitty apartment in giant expensive city is back.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought he went into, at some point he's running around and he run around to a place we hadn't seen before. Like, how big is this place?
Yeah.
It's got like a whole
There's
other
so
half
many apothecary cabinets.
Yeah.
Just, I like, know. Nice skylight.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right,
how dare
here we go.
Steven.
Let's do around the dial. Okay, here we go.